Good afternoon, and welcome to Friday's edition of Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today. And today we've got a full show where we're going to be talking to Bill Gardner, who's the Vice President of Programming at PBS. And we're going to call him, and he's going to tell us all about Wild Alaska Live, this thing that's descending upon Juno. We're also going to be talking to Colette Costa about details of happenings at the Gold Town Theater and to the owners of a new restaurant in town, Four Plates. Also, Christine Trott will be here to highlight the Horsey event on Saturday. And Lionel Udipa, the chef at Salt, is competing at the Alaskan Seafood Competition, and we'll talk to him all about that. That's coming up, plus Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, a lot more. That's all happening. First is National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Hannah Colton, in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Nation won a legal victory last week when a federal judge in Utah ruled that election district boundaries in San Juan County are unconstitutional. It's the second time U.S. District Judge Robert Shelby has thrown out the county's election maps in a racial gerrymandering case that dates back to 2012. The county was ordered to redraw the districts last year, but Shelby ruled the new maps still used race as the predominant factor in packing voters into sometimes irregularly shaped districts. In a statement, Navajo Nation Attorney General Ethel Branch called for the swift replacement of current county officials, saying they're, quote, not the legitimate representatives of the people. Judge Shelby also rejected new maps proposed by the Navajo Nation. Instead, he said he'll appoint an independent expert to oversee redistricting. The rate of uninsured Native American adults and children across the United States has gone down since 2008. That's according to a recent study out of Georgetown University, which shows that despite that decrease, the proportion of uninsured Native Americans still remains higher than the population at large. Lee Strubinger has the story.
According to a nationwide study of health insurance coverage rates from 2008 to 2015, the uninsured rate for American Indian and Alaska Native children and families has declined from 36% down to 28%. Joan Alker is a research professor at the Georgetown University McCourt School of Public Policy. She says many states with large Native populations expanded Medicaid in 2014, and that led to a considerable reduction in the uninsured rates in various states.
For example, New Mexico, 25% decline in the rate of uninsured Native American adults. There are some states like Montana, which didn't take the expansion until 2016, so this data won't capture that, and Alaska, which took it in 2015, already is seeing their uninsured rate come down for adults, but we would expect when we get new data this fall that we will see larger declines for those states.
Alker says Medicaid cuts, like those proposed by Senate Republican leadership in the health care overhaul bill, would devastate Native families. She says that's because a lot of Indian Health Services operations are paid for by Medicaid dollars.
Because the Indian Health Service is underfunded and because it too relies on Medicaid, this would be a double whammy for this population because they need Medicaid and it will also harm the Indian Health Service.
I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Actors from more than a dozen different tribal nations will be featured in a movie being produced by the Chickasaw Nation. KCNP's Brian Brazier visited the set in rural Oklahoma and has more.
Set in the mid-1800s, the Chickasaw Rancher tells the story of an orphan Chickasaw named Montfort Johnson, who became a renowned cattleman in Indian Territory while building relationships with other tribes in the area. The role of Johnson is being played by Martin Sinsmeyer.
Our culture is never static. Our technology evolves. Our ways evolve. So it's great to see that with the availability of resources that, you know, storytelling is evolving. And Chickasaw Nation is doing a great job, an amazing job of following the tradition of telling stories and telling their own stories. I think that's really special.
Another lead character in the Chickasaw Rancher is that of Johnson's Cheyenne friend Rising Wolf, played by Oglala Lakota, Omaha and Navajo actor Tatanka Means, who identified with his character.
What I like about him, and that I can relate to, is that he's wanting to stay more with, you know, his traditional side. He's still, you know, raising his family on the land and trying to, you know, keep that traditional side alive.
Chickasaw Nation Governor Bill Anitubby says it's more than one man's story.
Coming through tough times, being able to stand up against all kinds of diversity and able to be a success, even though that occurs to you. This is a perfect story to tell.
Other primary roles are played by veteran actors Dermot Mulroney, Tommy Flanagan, and James Landry Hebert. For National Native News, I'm Brian Brazier.
And I'm Hannah Colton.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members fight against poverty while earning money for college and gaining skills, with rewarding service opportunities around the country and info at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Wildlife. Let's talk about some wild stuff that's been happening. I think unless you've been under a rock, you realize that PBS and BBC have a co-production happening in Juneau. It's very exciting. It's Wild Alaska Live. And on the phone with me right now, he actually just arrived in Juneau, but he's on the phone with me right now, is Bill Gardner, who's Vice President of Programming and Development for PBS. Bill, are you there?
I am.
Oh.
Hi, Andy.
Well, hey, thanks so much for joining us today and talking to us a little bit about this amazing project that everyone's very excited about here in Juneau. And, you know, social media is alive and people are driving by where the production stuff's happening. And all of us in Juneau probably have one friend or another who's doing something to do with the show. I have a friend who works in trees and helps set up some of the cameras, camouflage cameras around eagle's nests and things like that. So there's all that kind of cool stuff that's just been going on. So thanks for bringing that to Juneau. I guess I'll ask, first of all, how did it all start and develop? How long has this been in the works?
Well, we've been working with the BBC to try to work into some live natural history for a couple of years now. 2 years ago, we went live from Monterey Bay Aquarium down in California for a Big Blue Live, and it was a really successful project for us. You mentioned social media and all of our multi-platform approaches. You know, we're made up of a lot of local stations who are interested in what's going on in their backyard as well. So we could really magnify an interest in the natural world all over the country through that one project. And it was such a big success. We wanted to go bigger and bolder and wilder. You know, how do you do that without coming to Alaska? You know, this is as wild as you can get. So here we are. And we're really, really pleased to be here. We've been received just absolutely warmly. It's just gorgeous, and we're just really excited for what we're getting ready to drop on Sunday.
And what you said is kind of an interesting thing, the idea of live natural history. So it's an interesting thing as a lifelong person who's watched, you know, natural shows, nature shows, including Nature on PBS and all these great shows. There's often a kind of narrative that gets told where there's a bit of, you know, there's a small animal growing up. It has all these different challenges, and then the mother protects it. You know, those kinds of, like, narratives happen. And I wonder, is that something that you're trying to get away from, or are you trying to interpret those things that are happening while they're happening?
I would say we're building upon that kind of thing. Those are really great mechanisms to get people to be engaged and entertained and to care about the natural world. But at the same time, you know, we're the public broadcaster, as is the BBC, and we look at ways that we can bring people places they wouldn't normally be able to go to. And this is an example of that. You know, and you mentioned narrative stories. There's all kinds of narrative stories happening all around us in the real world. And, you know, you live in Juneau. I'm originally from Maine, and I've been to Alaska myself a couple times now. And, you know, that just being out in the wilderness, there are stories, and you can feel that you're a part of it. And for those folks who don't have the opportunity or aren't able to get out in the wild like this, this is a chance for them to do that and see that. And, you know, we're working with a lot of local experts and the Park Service, and everybody around here that we've encountered has been really, really supportive with the guiding services and so forth to take people into the stories that are happening, not just maybe, as you mentioned, this little animal who's trying to grow up and go through the trials and tribulation of their own lives, but looking at it in a bigger picture perspective, you know, because we're a part of the environment. We're a part of the world around us, and not good, it's not bad, it just is.
Yeah.
So we're really trying to give people the chance to see what it's actually like in real life. You know, there's folks who do that kind of stunt live natural history, and that's fine, but it's a stunt, and we're showing things as they actually are, which is why we're here when we're here. You know, there's probably about 2 years worth of research that went into determining just when are the salmon going to hit, and I think we're going to get it down to the day or maybe a day behind. So it's an exciting time to be here.
Yeah. Are there technological advances in how you are able to capture these moments that make this possible that maybe it wouldn't have been possible 10 or 15 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. You know, even whether it's satellite technology or just the size of cameras that you can do things with. And a lot of it has to do with being unobtrusive in the environment. You know, if you walk through the Mendenhall Glacier area up here, the way that these cables are just run and hung above the ground, because we had a little problem with porcupines chewing on our cables, but, you know, the fact that
the
you walk these trails and
it's
like,
on the unforeseen,
you know,
problems.
I mean, we're like, there's going to be bears or wolves right. Or what are you going to worry about? It's the porcupines. You know, but there's like four cables that are fiber optic that are just hanging in the trees. It's totally unobtrusive, and we're able to come out and broadcast all the way live globally through the BBC and then nationally for us. And we've got cameras in beaver lodges. We've got cameras above bird's nests that just do not impact the animals in any way or leave any impact on the environment whatsoever. You know, we'll be using drones and helicopters, and all of that is just being sent wirelessly all over the world. So it's a really interesting time now with what you can do technologically.
And from a programming standpoint, I guess I'm just wondering, like, how can you count on that beaver to be there and to be doing something? You know what I mean? It's one of those things where mm-hmm. often in a show that's a produced natural show, a producer may spend months upon months upon months to get the shot, you know, that's needed. And relying on that shot or those things that allow you to tell a story about an animal happening live, how do you kind of deal with that?
Well, there's a couple pieces of that. First is, you know, practice, right? We've mm-hmm. got some of the best natural history filmmakers in the world on this project, and there's been a lot of running down all the possible permutations of what could go down to make sure the cameras are in the right place and so forth. At the same time, embracing that this is the story that we're telling in live television. You know, we're not trying to manufacture anything. You know, this is the salmon run. This is when the spawn is happening, and we know the beaver lodges are going on, and we can kind of keep an eye on them, and we know where the bears are. We have scouts out looking for humpbacks and orca and so forth. So, you know, we're able within the show to be able to bounce around to the various locations as action is happening, and we've also tried to schedule it in such a way that we know it's the highest possibility where that is going to take place. And, you know, with the local experts we've got on hand to just tell the stories as they're happening. If we're able to watch eagles dive bombing these salmon all day long, then, you know, that's entertaining, and there's a lot of messaging that can be done around that. Again, we're not doing this as a stunt. We're trying to portray Alaska as it actually is, and as a local you know very well, there's a lot of action.
Yeah. Is there one particular type or sequence or animal you're trying to capture that is either making you the most nervous or is kind of the coolest thing that you think could possibly happen?
Well, you know, when you're dealing in the marine environment, that's the most mm-hmm. unpredictable. When we did Big Blue Live, we were trying to land this by capturing a blue whale live for the first time ever. And we had cameras, boats trying to spot one, and we found one. And, you know, you have to time the dives. And you got somebody with a stopwatch as a marine biologist saying, well, it's going to come up again now. So can you catch it? And we were able to nail that just right. So, you know, we're really hoping we can get some orca this time around. But we know that the bears are really what people want to see. And we think with the salmon coming, we've got the best possible attractant you could have. So it's really the whole picture of being in Alaska that we're looking for, and we think that we'll be able to deliver it and bring home a really entertaining show, especially with the Kratz hosting it.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Great
so
storytellers.
Let's talk a little bit about that. The Kratz actually have a special happening thing on Monday, which is Wild Kratz Alaska, and they're featuring a salmon's journey.
Yeah, that's right. They've been a huge, huge piece of the public television landscape in our kids' offerings. And, you know, they just did an event over there at K2 the other night. And
well, you know what?
400
it had to,
families were
it
there.
Had to move. It was it got too
had
big.
To move.
So it went to the high school
yeah.
instead. Yeah. So it was so huge yeah. that, yeah, the reaction was just tremendous for the Kratz. Yeah.
It's fantastic, you know, and that's one of the things that we really are also trying to expand on as the public broadcaster of America is do co-viewing. We want to give opportunities for families to watch stuff together, you know, and this is going out at 8 p.m., so hopefully the kids who are big Kratz fans and their parents know them, obviously, we'll pull them in to try to watch something in primetime, and then the primetime audience can just really get this access to guys who are of the wild. You know, this is what they do with their entire career. They're not just people out there trying to draw attention to some kind of sensationalist issue. These are guys who are out there and live it all the time. So, you know, they're having a fantastic time out here and all the side trips they've been able to take. Martin Kratz was up at 6 a.m. today going and looking at the bald eagles going after the salmon. And Chris was just on Kodiak looking at brown bears. So there's a lot to like.
Yeah, very cool. You kind of listed a few of the there's sort of these all-stars of animals, right? Are you trying to cover every kind of the major animals that people know Alaska for? I mean, we've already mentioned bears. Are you also looking for wolves and moose and wolverine or what are some of the kind of main?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're very much into finding some wolves out in the wild, especially those that go after the salmon. You know, that's kind of the core story that we're following is this summer feast. When the salmon come in and how that impacts the entire ecosystem all around them, that the bears feed on them and leave the carcasses which end up feeding the trees. It's this holistic system and anything that takes part in that, we want to highlight that story. So, you know, if we've got camera traps set up all over the place, remote cameras. There might be animals that wander by that allow us to kind of tell what that story is. We also want to talk about the fact that human beings have lived here for a really long time, and this economy is important to the people who live here as well. You know, it's not just wolves and bears who rely on the salmon. It's also the people who live here, too, you know, and the economy that goes with it, living in the wild. So it's really just trying to tell that story as much as we possibly can.
And how did you hit on that as the story that you thought was the narrative that would tie everything together?
Well, when you're trying to do live natural history especially, you got to look at something that's actually happening. And that's what's really important to us. As I've said a few times, we don't manufacture anything. So what are some of the big events that take place and what can be built around that to, again, answer the question you had about how do we try to hedge against nothing happening? Well, you picked the right time to be here, right? So this was the big event in this part of the world. We know there's a lot of interest in Alaska itself. And to be honest, the time zones work out for the BBC over in the UK and for us to be able to air it in prime time. So those are some of the things that go into making the decisions about what to cover. And the things can flow from that because we do also want to send those types of messages and tell those types of stories about the natural world as it actually is.
Yeah.
And this is this works perfectly for that.
It seems like PBS and BBC are sort of uniquely qualified to take on that task, you know, the idea of commitment to telling the story as it is.
Well, we like to think so. You know, this is what's really important to us. The world is an interesting place as it is. You don't have to make things up.
That's good. All right, so it's premiering July 23rd, this Sunday. Is that right? Yeah. And
that's right. We go out this Sunday, and then on Wednesday, following it up, where we're doing a lot on the glacier up here, and then the following Sunday, we're going to bring it home with the wrap-up, and hopefully we'll get a bunch of wolves and orca in that one for you.
Oh, man, amazing. So it's July 23rd, 26th, and 30th. They all play at 8 p.m. Eastern time. That means it'll be on at 4 p.m. here in Alaska. Is that?
That's right. And yeah. I believe that K2 is. And I believe that you guys are going to follow up and air it again at 8. But check your local listings.
Yeah, very good. Okay, well, thank you so much. Big week ahead of you, Bill.
All fun.
Culmination of a number of years of work here for you and for the folks at the BBC. So, again, exciting for us here in Juneau to have you guys in town and telling this story that, as you say, we live out all the time. It's wonderful to have other people understand the life that we live here, a little piece of it anyway, and the beauty of the natural surrounding where we live here. We're really proud of it, but it's great for you guys to be here telling that story as well. So thank you.
Oh, we're absolutely thrilled to be here, and you know the reception we've got is really fantastic, so thanks back at you.
Okay. Bill Gardner, Vice President of Programming and Development for PBS. Thanks again, and again, it's Wild Alaska Live, and it's happening July 23rd, 26th, and 30th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and here in Juneau we'll repeat again at 8 o'clock our time, Alaska time. Bill, once again, thank you.
My pleasure, Andy. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm just not a scooper, like a freaking real scooper. I got the jump, I got the NOAA Fisheries asks you to help prevent sea lion entanglements. Please remember to lose the loop. Prevent nuisance by cutting any loops before discarding in the trash. Stash the trash. Keep plastic trash out of the ocean. And keep the sea entanglement free to prevent injury and death to marine wildlife. To report an entangled marine mammal, call the Alaska Marine Mammal Stranding Network at 1-877-925-7773. This message brought to you by NOAA.
This is Stacia Harris from the Year of Kindness Steering Committee. As part of 17YOK, all sorts of groups are adopting specific weeks during which they do something to help spread kindness. This week's group is the Mount Juno Gastineau Lodge. You can sign up for a week by emailing 17YOK@junopolice.com. Together we can make Juno a better place to live.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today. Hey, the Parks and Rec hike for Saturday, that's tomorrow, is to the Eagle's Nest at Eagle Crest. Saturday is also, this is a big one, Saturday is also International Salad Day. So to commemorate this event, the hike leader will provide a variety of lettuce and asks hikers to bring toppings for the salad along with their own cutlery and a plate. So meet at the Eagle Crest parking lot at 9:30 a.m. tomorrow. No dogs or firearms for this hike, and carpooling is encouraged. And have a great hike. That's the Park and Rec's Parks and Rec hike for Saturday. That's tomorrow. And it's going up to the Eagle's Nest at Eagle Crest. So have a great time out there hiking. We're going to be hearing from Garrison Keillor and Writer's Almanac in just a second here. We got some other guests coming up in just a moment as well. The forecast for the rest of the day right now, it's 67 degrees, and it's going to be mostly sunny with a high near 65 degrees. So we've already surpassed that for the rest of the day. And tonight, a 30% chance of rain for tonight, and that's mainly after 2 a.m. Rain is forecast for Saturday and Saturday night as well, and scattered showers on Sunday, mostly cloudy going into the beginning of next week. Right now, here's Garrison Keillor with Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 21st of July, 2017. The first train robbery in this country took place on this day, 1873. The James Gang held up the Rock Island Express in Adair, Iowa. It's the anniversary of the first Wild West showdown. It happened in Springfield, Missouri, 1865. Wild Bill Hickok got into an argument with a cowboy named Davis Tutt. Argument had to do with a woman and a gambling debt. They decided to have a duel. They faced off in the street, a distance of about 75 paces. They fired simultaneously. Tutt's shot went wild, and Hickok's hit Tutt through the heart. And a few years later, a writer named George Ward Nichols wrote about it in Harper's New Monthly magazine that made Wild Bill a household name throughout the country. It's the birthday of Hart Crane, born Garrettsville, Ohio, 1899. His father, successful candy businessman. By the time Hart Crane was a teenager, he knew that he was gay. He moved to New York, hung out with poets. His drinking got the best of him, and in 1932, at the age of 33, he killed himself jumping overboard a steamship on his way from Mexico to New York, leaving behind his masterpiece, the poem, The Bridge. It's the birthday of novelist and teacher John Gardner, Batavia, New York, 1933, best known for his novel Grendel, the retelling of Beowulf from the viewpoint of the monster. Also for his book The Art of Fiction, a standard text for many novelists. And it's the birthday of Ernest Hemingway, Oak Park, Illinois, 1899. In July 1925, he visited Pamplona in Spain for the celebration, the bullfighting, the running of the bulls, and so forth. He and his wife arrived a few days early, and On this day, 1925, on his 26th birthday, Hemingway began his first novel. He said, "Everybody my age had written a novel, and I was still having a difficult time writing a paragraph." So he sat down in hotels and bars in Madrid and an apartment in Paris, and 2 months after he'd begun writing in Pamplona, he finished the first draft. He called it Fiesta at first, and then The Lost Generation, and finally The Sun Also Rises. Sent the manuscript to Scribner's. It was picked up by the editor, Maxwell Perkins, who liked it a lot. The book was published in 1926. Got some good reviews, but Hemingway's own mother did not like it. She said, "It is a doubtful honor to produce one of the filthiest books of the year. Every page fills me with a sick loathing. If I should pick up a book by any other writer with such words in it, I should read no more, but pitch it in the fire." It was his second novel, A Farewell to Arms, that came out in 1929, that became a bestseller and enabled Hemingway to make a living writing fiction. Here's a poem for today by Gerald Loughlin, "Timing is Everything." The horoscope this morning really put me on my guard, sent the adrenaline coursing through my veins as it predicted a crucial confrontation that would require all the will and ingenuity that I could muster, until I remembered I was looking at a week-old student newspaper. "Timing is Everything" by Gerald Loughlin, from Poets and Pleasure Seekers, published by Spout Hill Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, now available on iOS devices. Subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Don't miss 4 days of incredible entertainment at the Southeast Alaska State Fair, July 27th through 30th in Haines, featuring the Grammy Award-winning Eric Krasno Band, Indian Electronic Canadian Touring Band, Delhi to Dublin, plus Henry Osborne, John Wayne and the Pain, New Sound Underground, and more live music and entertainment at the 49th Annual Southeast Alaska State Fair. Information and tickets at seakfair.org.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein with you, and Christine Trotz here with me as well from the Fairweather Equestrian Center. You were just saying we're just filling each other in on the details for this really fun practice event that's coming up tomorrow morning. So it's happening at 9 o'clock out at the Equestrian Center, which is out on Crazy Horse Drive. So, yeah, tell me a little bit about what's going on tomorrow starting at 9.
We will be having this as a practice session so that the kids have a chance to get tuned up in order to attend the actual shows that we have August 27th and 28th and September 16th and 17th.
So those shows are kind of formal,
yes,
you
with
know,
actual judges that are
right.
Certified horse show judges.
But this is a tune-up kind of. This is an
yeah.
This is the ability
it's a
for
practice. The kids won't have to wear formal attire. They will be required to wear helmets and hard-soled boots with heels and proper pants and things like that. We have it actually from children all the way through adults of a certain age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know. And it's a learning in a situation so that the longtime horsewoman, Leah Kaddish, who's been here for a long time, she's done a lot of teaching, is going to be our judge, and she will take the time to explain to the kids the class and critique it so they can figure out what they have to work on.
So if people go and see this tomorrow, they'll be able to see someone go out, do what they're doing. Is it different types of writing and different types of things that's going to be
there
happening?
There will be Western writing
okay.
classes and English classes, and the classes are groups of horses going out together.
I see, okay.
So they do the commands that the judge asks them to do, and it's got loudspeakers telling the riders what they have to do. And
so they don't, oh, I didn't quite know that. I kind of thought, oh, they had a routine, they ran through it, and then the judge. But instead, it's the ability for them to correctly do things spontaneously as the judge. They don't know what's going to be called until it gets called. Yeah, okay.
And the judge will observe the riders and mark down who does this and that best or not, or, you know.
Right.
And that's why she will critique it afterwards
to
help the kids figure out what they need to work on.
How many individual riders is there per class typically?
Well, here in Juneau, we have a smaller horse population, so these classes are sometimes rather small, like 3 to 5 people at a time. Regular classes usually have between 10 to 20, depending on where you are. That's down south.
So in those ones down south, when those are happening and there's 20 horses, how many judges are there? I mean, how can they tell who's, you know what I mean? How do they keep track of everyone?
Well, sometimes on very large classes, they'll split the class. But often they have them all in the arena at once. The arena is usually larger. And it's oftentimes first impressions. So as you enter your gate, you have to really be ready to show your horse.
Oh, really? Okay, yes. It's a judged event, and all those things matter. Yeah.
Yeah.
So What's the ratio of how many people ride Western and how many people ride English here in Juneau?
Here in Juneau, everybody is multi-purposed.
Okay.
We have very versatile horses. They ride English and Western, and some of them jump as well. And dressage.
Yeah. And so what's the advantage of the different styles?
Western is a working kind of riding. It's also a nice trail riding pleasure out in the wilds where you have the security of a good big saddle and a horn and things like that. English is kind of an athletic form of riding, and it goes with jumping over hurdles and also working in dressage, which is a fine schooling, higher schooling of the horse so that they're really receptive. But Western also has some very fine schooling. They have reining. They have cutting of cattle. The cutting is great. They have just regular Western pleasure. And so they both have very broad applications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. And as you said, the saddle's kind of different for each.
Very different.
Right.
So,
yeah, there's English saddles and there's Western saddles, and they don't mix.
Not at all. No.
Right.
The Western saddle has a lot more leather to it. It's a heavier saddle, completely different type of riding style. The English saddle is lightweight and smaller and flatter and used for jumping or dressage or cross-country endurance riding, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Do the horses kind of know, just based on the saddle, what's kind of coming?
Many horses recognize the difference in tack and behave accordingly.
Huh, that's really interesting. Yeah.
Western horses have to go smooth and quietly, and they have a jog. English horses, they have to be a little bit more up and move forward more lively, and they have trot, not a jog, canter, not a lope, and they'll do hand gallop and things like that.
Wow, well, it's fascinating. I mean, the world of, obviously, it's an entire world, the world of equestrian, the equestrian world. It's amazing. So Fairweather Equestrian Center is out on Crazy Horse Drive. It's at 112-10012 Crazy Horse Drive. This really fun-sounding event, this practice show happening tomorrow at 9 o'clock, starts at 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
Might go a few hours. Are we
I would expect 3 to 4 hours,
yeah, right.
Certainly.
Free to come and go and that sort of thing? And
absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
We will be serving hot dogs and hamburgers, baked goods, pop, coffee, hot water for cider, and just water bottles as well.
Cool.
And we just ask you to donate what you think would be a reasonable donation for the food you use. And there is not seating, but you can stand in the aisles and watch the arenas, and we encourage you to cheer and clap right, for
sure.
their favorites.
Yeah, absolutely.
And one of the reasons we like to celebrate the horse is that the horse is where civilization began. It's the backbone of civilization, and that's why you have cars measured in horsepower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we still, it's good for the inside of a person.
Yeah, to get out on a horse and to see them and observe them and just be around them as well, yeah.
They're beautiful animals.
Well, thanks so much. Again, it's the practice show. It's happening tomorrow, 9 o'clock. This is in preparation for a couple of shows, August and September, maybe
Correct.
A preview to folks what when those are going to be happening.
Yeah, August 27th and 28th. It's a two-day show, and we will have certified judges. And then September 16th and 17th, also a certified judge. And there's will be a photographer for these events, and we're looking forward to a lot of fun.
Yeah, should be really fun. 9 o'clock tomorrow is the when you can go see the practice show. Christine Trott from the Fairweather Equestrian Center, thanks so much for coming by and let us know about it.
Most welcome.
Okay. Welcome back to Juno Afternoon, joined here by a couple of chefs in the house. Lionel Udipa is here, and also Jacob Picard. Thanks to both of you guys for coming in.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
And Lionel, you're the head chef at Salt. Is that the correct title?
I am.
And Jacob, you're the sous chef there.
That's correct.
So, okay, I'm going to ask the question. What's the sous chef?
That's the under chef, so it's my job to make sure... everything that Nell wants to get executed.
You have
happens.
To do the work.
Yeah.
He's a bulldog.
Right. But it's not a specific, it's not about a specific style or specific type of responsibilities kind of thing.
Yeah, some specific responsibilities where if Nell's not in the kitchen, then, people should come to me
get
something done.
So we're here and talking about something pretty exciting, maybe a little nerve-wracking. I don't know.
A little bit.
A little bit.
It's the more excited than anything.
Great American Seafood Competition. You guys are going to go down to New Orleans. When does it happen?
It's going to be on August 5th.
Okay. And you're going to rep Alaska and Juneau and everything else with seafood. Can you give away a little bit about what types of stuff you might be leaning towards doing?
Yeah. So first of all, I want to say it's about 20 to 30 chefs from.
It's a huge competition.
Yes,
yeah. Right.
From all over the states, and we will be doing a Dungeness crab risotto.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. Pretty. Mm-hmm.
That
pretty nice.
Amazing. You know, because risotto is so rich.
Correct.
And then adding that crab in there is going to be, I can really see that working. Yeah.
And then, so we'll have some garnishes as well. We'll have either pickled bull kelp.
Okay.
To kind of help with the richness of the dish.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have some black seaweed that we got from Angoon that we just pulverized with a mortar pestle, and we'll kind of use that to dust the whole plate.
Just give it a briny kind of characteristic to it.
Correct.
A little bit. Yeah.
And Jacob over here has been making a black cod fish sauce for the last 7 months.
That's pretty awesome.
Really working on it there.
You guys
so
love the smell.
Very, very rich, I would think, right?
Well, fish sauce is actually it's quite savory. And you get that umami factor, which is, we use buzzwords, but I mean, that's, I think, the best way to describe it.
Yeah,
it's very rich and complex.
That very hard to describe flavor that everyone kind of
salivate.
Knows, but it's hard to describe exactly why it makes you salivate in a way. It's really kind of a key thing. It's interesting.
Or make your nose itch, either
way.
Right. So let's talk about how you hit on these recipes and how you hit on these ideas. Why those are the things that. So for the Dungeness risotto, why is that something that you decided, okay, this is going to be this really great representation of what Alaskan seafood is all about?
Well, right now we have a king crab risotto on our menu that we've been executing for the last 3 months. And we put that item on our menu temporary just to kind of help hold us until we come up with a new dish. But it's actually a really popular dish, and it's really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really familiar. Everyone kind of knows what mm-hmm. a risotto is. So the way we kind of throw the curveball is adding Dungeness crab, the Alaskan black cod fish sauce to kind of give it some savoriness,
mm-hmm.
Some salmon roe, which we didn't mention.
Oh, salmon roe as well.
Some salty and briny flavor, a little bit of vanilla. It's kind of for sweetness.
It's very nice.
And then the bull kelp and maybe some forage sea asparagus. We're not really sure yet.
And that just maybe depend on what you can get a hold of.
Correct.
Yeah, right.
So it's as Alaskan as it can get.
Yeah, and I like the idea of the Dungeness giving it a little bit more sweetness than the king crab typically does, right?
Mm-hmm.
I always think of Dungeness as being sweeter.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
we had a little R&D the other day between the king crab and the Dungeness, and I think everyone decided on the Dungeness.
Oh, yeah, that's mm-hmm. cool. Yeah.
So we'll be cooking that over some alder wood. And some natural coals.
Oh, all right.
For a bit of smokiness too.
Nice.
So we're hoping to hit all the flavor profiles that will make you think of bliss.
Yeah, exactly. Now, when you compete in this, are there stipulations in the way the competition works where they really want you to represent your area, or is that just something that you've just wanted to carry to the competition?
Well, I don't think there's any specific rule about using seafood from other locations throughout the U.S., but I think it's kind of implied that you're going to use a fish from your state.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so we're getting sponsored by ASME as well. Jeremy mm-hmm. Woodrow was the person that contacted me, and he contacted me at like 10:30 one night and was like, "Hey, are you interested in doing this Great American Seafood Competition?" And I was like, yeah, why
right,
not?
Sure. You're,
more than honored to. He's like, okay, well, I'll get it through to the governor and I'll have him sign off, and then I'll contact you in a few days. And then he called me the next morning at 7:30. It's like, pack your stuff and do some R&D. We're going to Louisiana.
There you go. Very cool.
Yeah.
Happened real quick.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exciting night.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, and we should mention that another chef in town here, Bo Schooler, went to this, and actually, you know, this is the thing, right? Pressure's on, because he actually won the thing.
Yeah.
I don't know, that was like 3 years ago or something like that. I can't quite remember.
Back in 2015.
2015, yeah, yeah. Right. So that's awesome, and so we've got this great tradition, and of course we have this growing and great tradition of incredible chefs here in Juneau. It's really cool, and everyone here who's listening benefits from that all the time, so that's great. So, but that's a really fun thing, to kind of carrying that tradition into the winning tradition into the competition is really fun. And, of course, Alaska seafood is paramount, you know, second to none. So you're dealing with the great raw ingredients, yeah. So what does it take as far as the logistics of making sure you get everything down to Louisiana and all that stuff?
A lot of organizing, for sure, and just timing.
Yeah.
You know, making sure that the Dungeness crab season closes, like, I want to say the first day of August.
Oh, okay.
So I probably shouldn't say this, but I'm gonna. We're getting Dungeness crab on the last day, and then we're gonna keep that in our crab pots, own personal crab pot.
Oh,
and
okay.
Then ship it out to Louisiana, and then have someone hold it in a tank there, so that's alive.
Yeah, you want them. Yeah, be fresh. Yeah. And what's the stipulation for how much you have to make? Do you have to?
There's seven plates we have to make.
Okay.
I think six judges, right?
Six judges, and then one of the plates is going to be for pictures.
Yeah, right. I see. So you're just plating seven, but so it's not overwhelming.
Right.
You guys do that all the time. Yeah.
And
it's
an hour to do it. I mean, that's a good amount of time.
It's a timed event.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh. All right. But yeah, just cooking, unless some disaster goes wrong with the risotto or something, or the crab crawls away.
Yeah.
You know, you gotta watch that.
Hating that happens.
Gotta catch that crab.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, very cool. Well, it's August 4th, and so we'll be looking forward to hearing the news on August 4th. And it's the Great American Seafood Competition. Salt is being represented and is representing Alaska, and with the help of Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. And as you said, it's something that the governor actually has to kind of nominate you, right, to be the one who represents. He has to authorize that you're going to be the representative of that state.
Yes.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's pretty big.
Yeah.
Really, we're really humbled.
Yeah, that's very cool. And then 20 states are represented. It might be the 20 states that are on the ocean. I'm wondering.
Yeah.
Seafood, right?
Yeah, right.
So it'll be interesting to, I think it'll be like really interesting to go up against like the New England chefs, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Going up against like the Florida chefs and you know that kind of stuff would be really amazing because they're going to come at it from a whole other angle.
Right.
There's a whole tradition, obviously, of cooking that has to do with those regions, but I think the stuff that you guys do is so cool because you bring in all these different influences.
Mm-hmm.
And then it becomes this Alaskan dish because of the influences that you guys bring. It's all really authentic. So that's
absolutely
something I always enjoy that about eating your food. I always enjoy eating your food.
Thank you. We always love having you.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, it's Lionel Udipa and Jacob Picard. Good luck, you guys, going down to the Great American Seafood Competition down in New Orleans. It should be good. All right. Coming up next, here's a bird note.
This is Bird Note. Kingfishers. They fish, right? The clue's in the name. Over most of the waters of North America, it's the belted kingfisher. Europe's single species is the small, brilliant blue, much beloved common kingfisher. But when you hit tropical regions of Asia, Africa, and especially the vicinity of Australia, it's clear that despite the group name, most of the roughly 90 species of kingfishers don't fish. They hunt in woodlands, where the smaller ones, like the 4-inch pygmy kingfisher, will eat grasshoppers and centipedes, and the larger ones will take frogs, reptiles, small mammals, and even snakes. Yep, Australia's laughing kookaburra is a member of the kingfisher family. And it's been known to dispatch snakes up to 3 feet in length. no matter whether the kingfisher you see is wrangling a snake or plunging for a fish. You'll be looking at a member of one of the world's most charismatic groups of birds. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Don't go. I never meant those words I said. Come over here and put my heart to bed. Ooh, baby, don't go. You know the night is so long. My heart is weak, but my love is strong. One more night, one more dark, smoky night. I can promise if you stay. One more night, one more hot, petty fight. And till moonlight turns to day. Hey, 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 ooh, ooh, ooh. Baby, don't go. Did you forget about me? You're so cut up, you're so damn lonely. Ooh. One more night, one more dark, smoky night. I can promise if you stay. One more night, one more hot, heavy fight. Until moonlight turns to day. Hey, hey, ooh. Baby, don't go. Did you know you are my true love? I threw my teeth while I pushed and shoved till I get what I want, and I want you. Ooh. One more night, one more dark, smoky night. I can promise if you stay. One more fight, one more hot, heavy fight. Until moonlight turns to day. Hey, hey, hey.
Who's that girl singing on that song? It's Annie B, and Annie B's in the studio with me.
Yeah, that's the first time I've ever played it.
That's the first time you ever played it? Was when you recorded it?
Well, no. This is the first time.
Oh, it's ever been played on the air?
Yeah.
When did you record it?
It was right after Folk Fest. Justin Smith of Rusty Recordings. We've been always talking about recording in Gustavus, and he's like, my gear's here. Let's just do it. It's like Justin's, the best time for your voice to record, too.
Justin's awesome. I mean, number one, he's like the best guitarist in Alaska.
In the world.
And he's really up there. He's
totally
amazing. I've had the honor of just hanging out with him some and having him just pick up a guitar and play and jam in front of me and stuff with other buddies of his. And it's so cool to just watch him really just, he just speaks through it. You know, he's just one of those people who speaks through that guitar.
And so modest, too.
Oh, yeah, he's a great, great person. Yeah. So that's cool. He's kind of doing recordings. He brought stuff here and did recordings here.
Yeah, we had him for the Red Carpet Folk Fest sessions. We recorded a bunch of artists up in the Alaskan, and then he still had his gear here and just made it work.
And that's a beautiful song. Tell me about that song.
It's one that I co-wrote with one of my buddies up north, Chad Ryan Van, who also has a studio. We recorded a rock version of that that'll be arriving sometime this fall. But I really wanted this B-side because, you know, I imagine playing those songs, that's the kind of arrangement I would do if I was here in Juneau. That's Cian Murphy and Clay Good on drums.
Very cool. So, all stars.
Yeah, Justin introduced me to the best in town.
Yeah. That's cool.
So, yeah, that was one that Chad, he sent me the chords and gave me a prompt, and then I was driving around, just thought, I want it to sound like this. I want it to be like this.
Did it come out how you wanted it to sound, kind of?
Yeah.
I mean, that's awesome. I mean, right? It's great if something, you have an idea in your head, you want it to sound a certain way, it gets recorded and it kind of turns out, or, you know.
Oh, yeah. Recording is the total process. And I was so happy with the way it came together with Justin. And it was up north, my buddy Chad, where I really, like, dug into it and started fighting, you know, because he has some sensibilities and is always trying to, like, overproduce. And I'm like, no, just take a step back. Like, I want it to sound like me. If I die or get pregnant, I want it to sound like my voice, not some pop star's voice in place of it.
Yeah,
And Justin really is on the side of it sounding very natural, which is cool. I mean, it's difficult to find hard quality recordings
that
sound like yourself.
Exactly right.
And Betsy Simmons is another one who I've worked with who is amazing at doing that thing too.
Over at Studio A, is that what they call it?
Right over
in the Jack. And speaking of the Jack, you're playing there tonight.
Yeah, I'm playing there at about 5:30. Party starts at 5.
Rock around the block?
Mm-hmm. It's just going to be me, solo acoustic, pretty laid back.
So you know, that and while there were drums and bass on that, it was pretty, you could do that solo.
Yeah,
right?
Definitely.
And that's the style that you would do it in, and that's why you wanted to get that recorded that way. That's cool.
Totally. But I am looking for a band.
Also, never stop looking for the band.
There are, like, some reliable drummers out there who don't live in Haines.
Reliable drummers, man. Well, that's not even...
Well, they're reliable, but they're, like, sought after. You have to break up someone else's band to get one.
Oh, you have to be that.
You got to be that girl. Finally got my membership at Peabody Studio.
Oh,
gonna get
yeah.
kicked out.
There you go. That's
Jason
right.
Jason Messon, I'm coming for you.
Yeah, that's right.
Sorry, George Kuhar.
It's going to be hard to break apart
coming
that band. That's tough, man. I think you might lose on that one.
I think you might lose, too. I've tried, Andy. Tried and lost.
So, and then you've got another thing happening over Ingus Davis, a fundraiser.
Yeah, I'm doing a fundraiser over there, opening for this really cool Austin guitarist who's playing at the Haines Fair. Her name's Jackie Venson. She's touring with Gary Clark Jr. this summer. And when he asked me, he's like, do you want to open for this, like, blues guitarist gal? It's, like, not a big deal, but it would be cool for you to see Gus Davis. And I was like, oh, sure. And then I checked out her music. And this whole week I've just been losing my mind because she went to the Berklee College of Music, so she knows how to sing and play guitar.
It's, like, amazing.
Just going to roll up Juno Corps. Went to Bluegrass Camp once.
How's it going?
Gonna do Alaska right.
Well,
she's also playing at the Haines Fair too. So.
Okay, cool. And tonight, 5:30 down at the Jack. It's Rock Around the Block, and then over in Gustavus. If you can get over to Gustavus, what day is that again?
That's Tuesday.
Tuesday happening over there. Get over there. It's a good reason, good excuse to go over to Gustavus and have a great time and watch Annie B playing music.
Pretty excited.
Annie, thanks so much for emergency coming in here. No one else showed up.
I planned it, Andy.
I know. I planned it, too, all the way. All right. And see you over at Rock Around the Block.
You betcha.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock around 10 o'clock tonight. Put your flat right so. Join me, home.
And that's it for this Friday edition of A Juno Afternoon. Have a great weekend, everyone. Stay safe and stay as dry as you can.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable.